Don't touch that dial. Don't tune away. It's time now for Radio Disclosure. And on Radio Disclosure today, our guest is Emmy Award-winning science reporter Linda Moulton Howe with a report on UFOs. After Linda Moulton Howe, we'll hear from Patrick Heron, the author of The Nephilim, Pyramid of the Apocalypse, and his new book, The Return of the Antichrist, all coming up on Radio Disclosure. As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Trans World Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building, and they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. Transworldantennas.com. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Emmy Award-winning science reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
One of the most important UFO-related government documents to emerge since the early 1980s is entitled, quote, Restricted Psalm 101 Majestic 12 Group Special Operations Manual, Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology Recovery and Disposal, stamped Top Secret, Magic Eyes Only, close quote, and dated April 1954, only 7 years after a UFO crash made headlines in July 1947 near Roswell, New Mexico. The cover page is also stamped with the official United States War Office seal that was still used in 1954. At my Science, Environment, and Real X-Files news website, earthfiles.com, I am reprinting the entire Psalm 101 training manual for Earth Files podcast listeners to view. Go to www.earthfiles.com's headline page and look for the Earth Files report dated May 28, 2009, about the Psalm 101 Extraterrestrial Training Manual. Chapter 2 begins, quote, Extraterrestrial technology is defined as follows. Aircraft identified as not manufactured in the United States or any terrestrial foreign powers, and not experimental military or civilian aircraft. Aircraft in this category are generally known as unidentified flying objects, or UFOBS. Such aircraft may appear as one of several shapes and configurations and exhibit extraordinary flight characteristics. Extraterrestrial biological entities, also known as EBAs, are described as creatures, humanoid or otherwise, whose evolutionary processes responsible for their development are demonstrably different from those postulated or observed in Homo sapien. Close quote. Page 5 describes four categories of unidentified flying objects: elliptical or disc shape, fuselage or cigar shape, ovoid or circular shape, airfoil or triangular shape. About the triangular shape, the training manual states, quote, "This craft is believed to be new technology due to the rarity and recency of the observations. Radar indicates an isosceles triangle profile, the longest side being nearly 300 feet in length. Little is known about the performance of these craft due to the rarity of good sightings, but they are believed capable of high speeds and abrupt maneuvers similar to or exceeding the performance attributed to elliptical disc or circular-shaped craft." Close quote. 1954 was 55 years ago. In the past half century, many people around the world have reported seeing large triangle-shaped aircraft that are silent. At each triangle corner, eyewitnesses report a circular white light, and at the center of the triangle is a larger circle of red light. One of the most dramatic close-up encounters happened in the Idaho backcountry of Challis, where four hunters had camped on September 27, 2000. Chris and Mark Bales are brothers who work together in their Bend, Oregon construction company that builds homes and commercial offices. The brothers have been going to the same Challis hunting area for nearly 20 years. With them on that September 2000 trip was their good friend Rob and Rob's father. The group had been out all day in the woods and had returned to fix dinner in their camp trailer. Around 9:15 p.m., Chris Bales left the trailer to go to his pickup truck to get food.
I reached over, opened the lid of the box. I had a sack of groceries in there. I was going to take them inside. And just as I was reaching down in there, I got just a really strange feeling. It was like if you were in a dark cave and people were holding like a really heavy wool blanket just over the top of you, and it wasn't touching you, but you kind of knew something was there. And for whatever reason, the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I looked up, and as I was looking up, I kind of stepped back off the tire, and I had a small flashlight in my right hand, and there was an object that was blocking out the sky completely. It was a perfect, clear, windless, beautiful evening. And this thing was blocking out the whole sky from one side of the draw to the other. It was a big triangular shape, each side being about a football field is what popped into my head, like goalpost to goalpost. So it was huge.
And that would be maybe 300 feet on a side.
Correct, yes. Pretty intimidating for me at that point. The sides and texture I could see with the flashlight. And the outer edge was like a flat, black, kind of charcoal-looking, smudgy dark that kind of blended in around the bottom edge of it, blended into a greenish gold, but pretty muted. Texture was like suede leather, black charcoal sides, came around down about to the bottom of the craft or whatever it was.
And that bottom was what color?
And the bottom of it was kind of a goldish green, really flat, nothing shiny. And there was no lights on. That thing sitting just above my head, somewhere between 100 and 200 feet above me. I know the trees were approximately 100 feet tall, so it was probably no lower than that. It was just sitting there, not making a sound. Something that huge basically levitated in the air, not doing anything. Non-comprehension of just about everything that I saw is probably one of the best ways to explain it. When my flashlight went across the bottom of it, it was like, whoops, we've been spotted. And these lights on each corner, on the underneath side, they were approximately, just a guess, at like 30 feet in diameter. And they just came on really slow. They reminded me of like a really dim dome light. But they didn't illuminate anything at all. It didn't light up the trees, didn't light up the ground. I could see the lights, but they obviously weren't for illuminating an area.
Chris, did they have color?
No, they were just a dim yellowish-white dome light is the closest thing I can come to describing what they looked like. And this is all happening in parts of a second here. And those came on first, and then right in the center of it on the bottom, which I described as like a Skippy peanut butter lid upside down, it seemed like it was almost three times as big as the outer corner lights, and that kind of came on real slowly, and it was like a really deep ruby red color. It wasn't bright. It didn't illuminate anything.
You're saying if the other lights were 30 feet in diameter, mm-hmm. that the central red light was about 100 feet in diameter.
Yeah, 90 feet, somewhere in there.
That's huge.
Yes.
Was that entire circle, the whole central part, did it come on as deep ruby red?
Yes, it did. All the same. None of it was brighter than any other part of it. I saw that come on, and at the same time, there was a extremely deep subsonic, like it was if you go down in a big dam on a river where the big turbines are turned by the water, an immense feeling and sound of a really low volume, low bass sound. I heard that. That's the only sound that we heard. It had been dead silent up to that point. That happened for like a fraction of a second, and then this thing started to raise straight up above me. And actually, it had to raise straight up because it couldn't move side to side or forward because the way the valley side came up, it would have hit something on one of the corners on there. And at that time, that's when I yelled out on my knees, trying to comprehend it. Holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, you guys have got to come see this. And that's when my brother Mark heard me, and Rob, and Mark came out the door, and I was kind of half trying to stand up, half on my knees, half on my feet.
How did you get to your knees?
The lack of comprehension of what it was just basically floored me. I mean, I just gave out.
In complete astonishment?
Yes, yep, non-comprehension. Astonishment doesn't even come close to describing it. I'd had a few bear encounters and been chased by a bear once. Didn't get me, but I thought I'd been scared that time. But after seeing this, I knew that I didn't ever really know what the word scared meant, but I do now.
Well, you're screaming for your brother and your two hunting buddies. What happens?
Mark came out first, and basically I kind of crawled half on my knees and grabbed hold of his shirt, pulled myself up and pointed up. Didn't say anything, just pointed up. And so Mark looked up. Mark and Rob had the presence of mind. They ran to their pickups, and both of them grabbed their binoculars and were looking at the object in their binoculars. It had started moving forward when I pointed up with Mark, so it wasn't still hovering above us. It was starting to move forward and move up this valley. It seemed like at an extremely slow moving rate. And I described the movement as if you took a hockey puck on ice and just gave it a little shove and just smooth and soft, just slid along the ice. That's what this reminded me of. Extremely powerful, making no noise. How can something this size do that? What is it? One of my other first impressions was that's not from here. Another impression was how perfect it was. When the light went across the bottom, there was no rivets, no screws, nothing shiny, no insignia, no identification of any sort on the bottom side of that.
How long had your truck been parked where you went out?
Well, it'd been parked there when we got back, so we'd probably been there maybe 45 minutes, I guess.
So, Chris, how did this huge football field size get into camp over your truck and be there hovering 100 feet or 200 feet above? It had to have been there when you went out to the truck and then you discovered it because you felt that strange feeling.
That would be my guess. I have no clue how long it was there. Yeah, we have no idea.
It implies stealthiness on the part of the triangle as if it came down low over where you all were, almost as if it was watching.
Sneaking up on us and monitoring what we were doing, I guess, was my impression. But whether it could hear or see us with my yelling and with the flashlight on there, pretty obviously I'd seen it.
What happened to the red light and the three white lights when it began to move?
They just stayed the same. Didn't get any brighter in intensity. Big ruby red light started to throb, I would say like a really, really slow pulsing heartbeat as it started to move forward and up the draw. That light came up to a really deep, low-pitched throb, deep bass that wasn't loud. It was just perceptible. You could just tell it was an immense amount of power. At that point, there was no more noise, just dead silent. You know it's there. You know it's not some sort of an illusion. This was dead real. It was there. Like the trees and the mountains were there beside us, this thing was over the top of us. Seconds clicked by slow. We kind of put a timeline together. The whole time from me spotting it to when it was out of sight was somewhere between 45 seconds and 60 seconds.
Do you have any gut sense about what you were so afraid of?
Just not knowing what it was, not comprehending. You know, you can't have something that big. It looked heavy. It looked solid. You can't do that. I've never seen anything like that happen, so how can that be happening?
And be silent for most of the time.
And be completely silent for all but a partial second. You know, we had mules that were tied up. They didn't do anything. Normally, they're like a watchdog. If anything happens, they let you know. No movement from them, you know, no braying or anything else. It's just incomprehensible. Immense power was the only thing that came through. Almost like you could just feel the sound more than hear it.
And your final view of it was what?
We watched it, you know, maybe 15 seconds as it kind of slid like on an escalator or on ice going up out of this valley that went from 6,000 feet to a little over 11,000 feet and approximately 7 miles long. We watched it till it went out of sight over the horizon of the mountain at the top. We went back to the trailer. I walked in first. The other guy, he was looking at me kind of strange. I kind of said, what? And he says, well, you're completely white. And I had a short sleeve shirt on and looked down, and my arms were as white as a sheet of paper.
Like the blood had drained to your organs.
Like the blood had drained clean out of me.
Yeah.
I was pretty shook up. You know, I couldn't even stay there. I tried, but I couldn't do it. We had to drive 3 hours to get to a motel.
What was going through your mind that you were so afraid of?
That I don't know. Kind of like Mark had said, I suppose something just sitting right over the top of you is kind of a threatening posture. When he saw it, it was moving away, so it wasn't in a threatening posture. I mean, it'd be like the difference between if you had a grizzly bear standing over the top of you looking at you to eat you, or if the grizzly bear's running away from you. You got a whole different feel on what's going on. No comprehension of what it was. I mean, that's what scared me.
Chris Bales' younger brother, Mark, works in their Bend, Oregon construction company. Mark Bales also flies his own plane and watched the huge triangular aircraft through 10 power binoculars with the eyes and mind of a pilot.
Yeah, I was in the camp trailer with two other gentlemen, and I heard Chris. I knew it was very urgent, so I just dropped everything I was doing and ran out the door. And he grabbed a hold of me and pointed up in the air, and that's when I saw the whatever it was, the UFO. I was in amazement because the object that I was looking at was actually climbing and moving off, but it was very large. I didn't hear anything. Even when I was in the camp trailer, Chris, I guess, could hear some sort of noise, but I didn't hear anything in the camp trailer. So when I'm outside looking up at this thing and I'm not hearing anything, I'm not smelling anything, I'm just in total, I don't understand what I'm looking at. My pickup was probably 5 yards in front of me, and I just ran up and grabbed my binoculars. There was another gentleman there beside me, and he did the same thing. I had 10 power binoculars, and I picked up my binoculars and watched this thing as it was ascending and moving off.
And what did you see?
Well, it looked like it kind of was shaped like a manta ray. Like looking at a manta ray, you know, swimming off, only it didn't have the tail. So out on the two tips of it, on both sides, you'd have the white lights. You know, it's climbing, so I can see the underside of it from behind, a pulsating red light that was soft and pulsing in the middle of it, on the underside of it. There were two white lights on both sides of that. You know, if you were looking at a manta ray from behind, it would be out on the tips.
Right, and it sounds like that maybe then the front light was tipped up away so you couldn't see it?
Right, because I wasn't directly underneath it. But I'll tell you what I could see that I don't think Chris saw, because he didn't see it from the same perspective that I saw it. But on top of it, there was a light glow of a dome-type white light-looking thing on top of it.
What was the shape?
If you took a fire alarm and set it upside down on a plate, it'd be like that.
Circular or?
Yeah, kind of a saucer shape.
So this was a round, raised portion up on top.
Yeah, but it wasn't very high. It was just slight.
It's round, and it is raised up a little bit, and white light is coming from it glowing.
Yeah, just a dim glowing light. It wasn't something that was bright. You probably couldn't even have seen it was there without binoculars. We were just standing there in amazement. I didn't even talk to him until we got back into the trailer.
As you are watching through binoculars, what is running through your mind about what this might be?
I was trying to figure out what I was looking at. I mean, it's kind of an odd thing. I mean, it's not often that you get to look at something and just come up with a big blank. I'm a pilot, so I understand, you know, what kind of flight characteristics aircraft have. I mean, when this thing, it didn't really bank like an aircraft. It just sort of slid. Couldn't hear a thing. Couldn't smell anything. So that was very perplexing, how something of this size could maneuver like it was with no audio sounds at all.
It is peculiar that your mule animals didn't react.
No, and usually they're the first clue that something's going on around your campsite, and they acted like there was absolutely nothing going on. That was very interesting.
Yeah. So what was the very last moment that you saw?
I think Chris told you the campsite was approximately 6,000 feet in elevation. The highest peak was right in the 11,000-foot neighborhood. We just saw this thing eventually disappear out of sight going over the top of the peak.
How did you end up contacting other people about this?
Well, Chris and I, we did sit down and drew up what we would seen. We had some GPS coordinates that we jotted down. And then he was so shook up that he was not going to spend the night there in camp. So what we did was we got in the pickup and we drove to a town and spent the night. The other two gentlemen had their animals there. Their mules were like family to them. They weren't leaving them, so they stayed.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent the night in town, and then the next morning, the next question in our mind was, you know, when you see something like this, what do you do about it? And I decided I'd call the tower in Boise, Idaho, because I didn't know who else to contact. And, you know, I kind of half expected the guy there to not take us serious. He was very interested in what we saw and very helpful. I just simply asked him if he'd seen anything strange on radar, and he asked me why, and I explained what we'd seen, and then he put us in touch with the assistant director of the Federal Aviation Administration. He gave us the numbers to Mountain Home Air Force Base. I think that's how we got in touch with Peter Davenport, and then we started calling these agencies, filing reports, and all of them, you know, I didn't know what to expect when I called them. Had the first guy laughed, I probably wouldn't have called the rest, but they were all very interested. Most of them had a conference call going on. They wanted other people to listen in on the conversation.
Hmm. Did anybody in authority, military, intel, police, anyone come to talk with you and your brother?
Well, we didn't know it, but right after we made the call to the military, I guess back in camp, maybe it's a coincidence, probably not, there were two jets scrambled that flew right over the exact coordinates that we'd given the military. So, you know, that was that following morning after we had made these calls.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently they were interested.
Which military would that have been, do you think?
You know, it's just pure speculation because I can't say anything for sure, but the closest Air Force Base was Mountain Home Air Force Base in Mountain Home, Idaho.
And after the jets flew over, what else happened?
Well, we just progressed back to camp. I might add that I guess the military called Chris's house three times. While we were still over there, we didn't leave. We stayed over for a few more days.
Mm-hmm.
But they were trying to get in contact with us through his home phone number back in Bend, Oregon.
When you got home after this trip, did you ever follow up and talk with the military people who had called?
We didn't really follow up with it. We'd made the calls that we thought we needed to make, and we just kind of left it alone after that.
We're talking on May 19th, 2009, which is almost 9 years later. What is in your mind today about this event and what this could have been?
You know, in my mind today, I still don't understand what I saw. It's still frustrating to really not get any definite answers. It's not something that you talk a lot about to people that haven't experienced the same thing because it seems to be a lopsided conversation. I would like to see it again. You know, it wasn't something that was threatening to me because it was moving off. I would really love to have some of this explained.
There is that haunting question. What was something the length of a football field doing down 100 to 200 feet right above your camp?
That's a great question. And really, you know, you can't really explain the precarious situation that would be in. I look at things from a pilot standpoint. This was very abrupt terrain. We were on the side of a valley, so this took some very high-tech, complex design to be able to maneuver where they were maneuvering.
As a pilot, what is your thought about something that might be defined as extraterrestrial from off-planet?
I think it's entirely possible. Like we told the military when we were talking to them, if you don't have one of those, you really need to get one because it was amazing. It was truly amazing.
And what did they say?
You know what? They were very serious about everything. They didn't laugh much.
And if it is from outer space, it means we're not alone in this universe and there are other intelligences that are far, far advanced beyond human.
Beyond anything I know, we're not the only ones that have seen this in that area. We were describing it to one of my good friends, and his uncle was there. And Chris was drawing this out in the dirt in the barnyard.
Right.
And he stopped Chris, and he finished the drawing. And it was exactly what Chris was going to draw.
This is a rancher in the Chalice area.
Yeah, and these are good friends. We just simply ask them, hey, you guys didn't see anything strange the other night, you know? And they said, like what? And we told them, and they explained that people in the area have seen this stuff. This wasn't on the same night, but they had prior to that night.
Prior to September 27, 2000?
Yeah.
And what did the rancher say about what he saw?
Well, they'd seen pretty much the same exact shape that we'd seen. They viewed it from more of a distance than we'd seen it. But they told me that this thing, well, I don't know if it was this particular craft that we'd seen, but they said they'll see lights in that valley that are in one position in 1 second, and then 50 miles away in just a millisecond, faster than you could describe.
The rancher is describing seeing unusual lights that seem to be able to jump distances in the same hunting valley and that they've seen this multiple times.
Well, yeah, most all of those people in the area that have lived there for, you know, 50, 60 some years have seen these things.
You can see a colored drawing of what Chris Bales saw close up over his truck. In my Earth Files report, Idaho hunters describe a huge triangle aircraft over their campsite.
You can see Linda Moltenhau's report at earthfiles.com. That's earthfiles.com. And if you've enjoyed this science report from Linda Moltenhau, she would love to hear from you. Please send her an email simply at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Email Linda at earthfiles@earthfiles.com and let her know that you heard her report on Radio Disclosure. As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Trans World Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building. And they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. Transworldantennas.com. If you enjoy listening to Radio Disclosure, we would really appreciate hearing from you. You can write us an email from our website, and that's radiodisclosure.com. All one word, radiodisclosure.com. There's a place, a tab, where you can click on it and send us an email. Please do that and tell us where you're located, what you're listening on, and how the signal's coming in. We really want to hear from you. Just say hello. Radiodisclosure.com. Our guest today is Patrick Herron. And Patrick is in Dublin, and he is the author of several books. And he has a new e-book out right now. And but in the past, you had two other publications, and let's talk about those for a minute so folks could get familiar with them, Patrick. The two other books that you had written. What are the titles?
Well, my first book was called Apocalypse Soon. That's a very short book. It's for people who are beginners and want to study the apocalypse, which is the book of Revelation. I wrote it in 1997, and it got into the bestsellers here in Ireland. After I did an interview on national radio, and the guy said he read it in one sitting and he was gripped. So 2 years after that, I brought out another book called The Apocalypse Generation. That didn't do as well because they wouldn't let me on the national television anymore. And then in 1994, I published my book called The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, which has been very successful. In the United States, it was number one in the prophecy section of Amazon Books for 2 years. And then one of the top 10 publishers in the States bought the rights a couple of years ago. And it's been selling quite well ever since. And the Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, the first half of the book, is a thesis on who built all these ancient monuments that populate the world, such as the Great Pyramids of Giza, Stonehenge in England, Newgrange in Ireland, Machu Picchu in South America, the Great Pyramids of Mexico, the Nazca Lines in Peru, the various other buildings in Guatemala, Angkor Wat in Cambodia, the Giant Heads out in Easter Island, all these ancient anomalies that populate the world. My book is a thesis on these guys called the Nephilim, the fallen angels.
Let me ask you a question now. Why was it you said that they would not let you on national television anymore?
Basically because they don't like. I'm a Christian, Ted. Okay, but I'm a sort of different type of a Christian. I don't go to any particular church or anything. I enjoy a few pints of Guinness at the weekend and the odd glass of wine. And I'm not affiliated to any church, but over here, If you're a Christian, then you're regarded as a bit nutty or a bit off the wall, a bit of a headbanger, and they won't really let you on the airwaves over here because they don't. You know, I remember I tried very, very hard to get on the national radio for my second book and for my third book, and after several months of trying, I remember saying to my wife, "You know what? If I was a one-legged humpback transsexual drug-pushing pedophile murderer, I'd have no problem getting an interview on the national radio. But because I'm a Christian, they won't let me on." So there's a lot of discrimination like that over here. It's not quite the same as the United States, where people are a lot more broad-minded. So I didn't get on to talk about my books, and as a result, they haven't been as successful as the first book. That's basically what I meant.
Well, and that is really not surprising, you know. I mean, considering the day and time we live in and the way things are, it's just not surprising at all.
No, it's not surprising. The powers that be don't want this stuff to be broadcast, and they don't want this information going out. And over in Europe is quite a, spiritually, it's a very dark place. There's a huge spiritual outpouring going on all over the world, just about everywhere else. Huge in South America and Africa and India, China, Korea, Japan. Even in the United States, there's, you know, a huge spiritual awareness over there. But in Europe, it's extremely dark spiritually. There's, you know, they killed God here a long time ago, and it's very, very dark place. And as a result, all the government organizations and radio stations and TV stations and stuff like that would be very anti anything to do with Christianity or stuff like that. So you're right. It's not surprising.
Well, you know, the subject matter that you're talking about here is extremely fascinating. And I guess I want to say that I realize that you're writing from a, well, not just a religious perspective. You're writing from the perspective of an author on a subject. And I'm sure there's a lot of folks that are attracted to this subject material because of its maybe sensational value. But taking from what I've been able to gather, the sensational value is not the reason why you've written these books, I guess is the best way to put it. So why don't you give us a primer? You know, my knowledge is somewhat limited, but in terms of the biblical side of things, I know that the Bible teaches that there were giants on the earth. We have to deal with this character by the name of Melchizedek. We have to deal with Enoch. We have to deal with all these things that are part of the Christian Bible, the King James Version, as well as the Catholic Douay Version that we have here. So I guess my question is how does all of this fit in?
Well, let me see. Where should I start? Basically, yeah, I'm not religious at all. I would like to think that I'm not religious for a start, Ted. I'm what you call spiritual. If you just read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you'll see the people who are always trying to trip up the Messiah and back him into a corner and organize his kangaroo court and his betrayal and his torture and eventual murder were religious people. They were the chief priests, the Pharisees, and the doctors of theology. So, you know, I understand what you mean when you say religious, but that's religion for you. You know, coming to a knowledge of what I'm talking about is a spiritual thing. It's a totally different thing. I mean, one of my favorite verses in all of Scripture is John 8:32, which says, "They shall know the truth, and the truth shall set them free." So it's all about being set free. So basically, I'll tell you, the central point of my book, in the last two books, and my new book is an extension of my book, The Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, which is a really, really in-depth study of the fallen angels of Genesis 6. You mentioned there was giants on the earth. Well, that's what it says back in Genesis 6:4. But the Hebrew word for giants in Genesis 6:4 is Nephilim. It means the fallen ones. They didn't know what the Nephilim were, so they put in the word giants. What it should read is that there was Nephilim on the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God went into the daughters of men, and they had children by them. And it said, "These became the mighty men, which were of old, men of renown." So it was the offspring of the fallen angels that were the giants that populated the earth in those times. Now, you know, these guys, according to my studies, they descended on Mount Hermon in the days of Jared, which is about 1,000 years to 1,200 years prior to the flood of Noah. And the flood of Noah happened around 2238 BC, 2238 years or 48 years BC. And these are fallen angels. These are, you know, Nephilim means the fallen ones, what you and I would call fallen angels. But I dislike the word angels, because anytime you mention the word angels, people either think of a little naked cherubim with no genitalia, or else some guy with long blonde hair and giant wings and spotlights behind them. But when you get in and study the appearance of angels, in fact, a better translation of the Hebrew and Greek word for angel would be messenger or agent. And when you get in and study the appearance of these guys in scriptures, they always appear as men. They're described as men. They look like men. They wear clothes. They eat. They drink. And apparently, these guys, when they descended and manifested on earth, could have sexual relations with ordinary women. So this is what appeared on the earth in these days, were fallen angels. But the difference between them and us is they are spirit beings. We are flesh and blood. So we are constrained by the laws of physics. But these guys are spirit. That's what angels are, and that's what God is. They're spirit beings, but nevertheless, they still look like us. And I think that's why it says about four times in Genesis, let us make man in our image, in the image of God made he man. So we look like them, they look like us. So a bunch of these guys, according to the Book of Enoch, there was 200 of them, descended onto Mount Hermon in the days of Jared, about 1,000 years before the flood, had sex with ordinary women who in turn had these giant offspring. And by the time the flood arrived about 1,000 years later, these guys had infected the DNA of everybody in the whole world, the whole population of the world, which could have been 20 or 30 million people at that time, had been infected with the evil and violence and bloodshed of these fallen angels. And things got so bad in the earth at that time that it says in Genesis there was only evil in the hearts of man continuously. So God sort of said, well, I've had enough of all this violence and evil and bloodshed. So he flooded the whole world. And all the offspring of these fallen angels, all the giants were drowned. The human race population was drowned at that time, except for Noah and his family. But you cannot drown spirit beings. And that's what these Nephilim are, spirit beings. So we're told that they're locked up in a subterranean prison, which is called, in the Bible, it's called the abyss. It's called the bottomless pit. And once it's called Tartarus. And of course, Tartarus, the other place that Tartarus is mentioned is in Greek and Roman mythology, where we're told that the gods are imprisoned because they rebelled against Zeus. And of course, this is these fallen angels descending on Mount Hermon is where we get all our Greek and Roman mythology from, which talks about the gods coming down from heaven. They live in Mount Olympus in Delphi. Zeus came down. He took Alcmene to wife. She almost died, giving birth to Hercules. This is where all this Roman and Greek and Egyptian mythology comes from. And this is where it all fits in with. So that's what my book has done, the first half of my book in the Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, is an in-depth thesis of these fallen angels and how their story from Scripture fits in with the Greek mythology, the Roman mythology, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Pyramid texts, and all that information. So that's the genesis of my study for the last several years, Ted.
Okay, well, you mentioned the Book of Enoch. And I know there's a lot of information in the Book of Enoch, especially on angels and fallen angels. Now, my question is why is the Book of Enoch not included in normal Bibles today?
Well, in fact, it was included for about 500 years, a long time ago. But then I suppose there was some sort of a church meeting, maybe 300 years A.D., and at this stage, you know, religion had taken over Christianity and they were back into wearing long cloaks and wearing collars and tall hats and stuff like this. And a lot of the spirituality had gone out and religion had come in. And they, in their wisdom, decided at some stage that it wasn't part of the canon of Scripture. So it was excluded. But, I mean, I don't put any pass on that very, very much. The reason that I relate to the Book of Enoch is because in the Epistle of Jude, which is a very short epistle just before the Book of Revelation, Jude, in his epistle, quotes directly from the Book of Enoch and makes reference to it. Now, Jude was a brother of Jesus Christ. Well, half-brother, I suppose. He was the son of Mary and Joseph. And so he knew about Enoch. So obviously the rest of the apostles and disciples knew about Enoch and believed and gave it a lot of credence. And obviously Jesus Christ himself would have known about it, or else it wouldn't be included in in Scripture, in Jude. And there are several other passages from the Book of Enoch that appear at various places in the New Testament. So, you know, because of that, I believe the Book of Enoch has a lot of credence attached to it and a lot of kudos. And when I was writing my book on the Nephilim, the fallen angels, when I went to the Book of Enoch and opened it up, I couldn't believe what I read in there, because it fills in so many, many, many blanks that are just not provided for in Genesis chapter 6 and elsewhere in Scripture. It just provides a lot of information. But, you know, just because it isn't in the canon of Bible doesn't mean that we cannot learn a lot from it. And perhaps God didn't want it in the canon of Scripture. Maybe he wanted it something outside, something that we could be revealed to us at this time of the end times in order to provide more answers for us, you know? So, you know, a lot of people tend to put God in a box, and they won't read anything unless it's in the Bible, and they won't read any Bible unless it's the King James Version. And, you know, a lot of people have a lot of funny ideas, but, you know, I don't put God in the box. When I found this, I knew that it was absolutely on the ball. And remember, it says in Genesis that there's only two or three verses about Enoch, and it says Enoch walked with God. Now, there's not too many men in the Bible anywhere where it says he walked with God. And it says he was taken and he did not die. He was taken away to heaven and he was shown all these things and he wrote them down. And as I say, it fills in a lot of the blanks. So the fact that it's not in the canon of Scripture doesn't worry me in one little bit, because as I say, the fact that it's been quoted by Job and referenced by Job, that gives it all the credence that anybody would need for it. And I do quote extensively from the book of Enoch in my book on the Nephilim, and also in my new e-book, which is called The Return of the Antichrist and the New World Order. So Enoch is a fascinating book, Ted, and we have a lot to learn from it. And there's still a lot of work to be done from that.
Radio disclosure will continue with our special guest, Patrick Herron, the author of the book The Nephilim, Pyramid of the Apocalypse, and his new book, The Return of the Antichrist. We'll be back with Patrick Herron right after this. As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Transworld Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building, and they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. Transworldantennas.com. If you enjoy listening to Radio Disclosure, we would really appreciate hearing from you. You can write us an email from our website, and that's radiodisclosure.com. All one word, radiodisclosure.com. There's a place, a tab, where you can click on it and send us an email. Please do that and tell us where you're located, what you're listening on, and how the signal's coming in. We really want to hear from you. Just say hello. Radiodisclosure.com. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Radio Disclosure continues with our special guest, Patrick Herron. Well, I have read the book of Enoch, and I found it to be a very scary text. And it's very challenging. The average
It's very scary, yeah.
The person who considers themselves a Christian. And when I talk about that, I'm talking about, you know, the average evangelical Christian that believes that or follows the route that is taught, and that is, you know, walking down the aisle and confessing your sins and receiving Christ and being, as they say, either saved or born again. If you're raised in that environment and you encounter the book of Enoch, it will make your hair stand up.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And see, the interesting thing, well, all my books are about the apocalypse. They're basically a summary of the prophecies of the book of Revelation and of the signs we are told will precede them. And as in every book that I've written, my knowledge of the book of Revelation has deepened and become more expansive. And at the end of the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, which was written, I think it's 500 years B.C., there's a lot of parallel prophecies from the book of Daniel that back up and parallel the prophecies in the book of Revelation. And at the end of the book of Daniel, after Daniel had written down the whole book, he asked the man that dictated the book to him. This man's name is Gabriel. He's an angel, but he's called a man. And he said to him, what do these prophecies mean, and when shall they come to pass? And Gabriel more or less told Daniel to mind his own business. He said, it's not for you to know these things. It says that they are sealed up until the time of the end. And he said, in the end times, many shall run to and fro, and their knowledge shall be increased. So, because we're in the end times now, this knowledge is being increased, and these secrets and mysteries that have been hidden in the book of Revelation and elsewhere for centuries are being opened up and revealed to his church, to his people now, so that we can know what's coming down the tracks and we can warn other people. And the book of Enoch is part of this revealing of stuff in the end times. I mean, for instance, you'll know from reading the book of Enoch, when he describes these fallen angels which came to earth and married human women and produced offspring by them, he describes them, and he says that they had privy members like horses. You remember that?
That's right. That's one of the scary parts.
That's a scary thing, right? Well, in my book on the Nephilim and the Pyramid of the Apocalypse, I have some pictures in there from Greece and Rome of hieroglyphs from some of the temples in Egypt. In fact, I have a DVD called The Return of the Nephilim, where I've got a whole bunch of these pictures from Egyptian reliefs showing these gods, and they all have privy members like horses. In other words, they're hung like donkeys, or they're hung like horses, we'd say over here. They're very, very big privy members. And there's a whole bunch of these all over Egypt. In fact, the one I have in my book, it's a very famous picture. A fantastic technical drawing of this guy, which is etched into stone somewhere in Egypt. And it's the Egyptian god Min, and he's got an erect privy member. I don't want to be too crude on your show, but that's what it is. We're all adults anyway. He's got an erect privy member, which indeed looks like a horse. And this is the god Min. And I've written underneath this that this is the god Min from ancient Egyptian temple. And I was tempted to put in there, if this is Min, I wouldn't like to meet his brother, Max. Because these guys were very, these guys are very, very well endowed, as you would say. And I do have pictures of them in my book and in that DVD, The Return of the Nephilim, also. So there's a lot of information in there. And this is all coming together now. See, the interesting thing about these fallen angels, Ted, is that when they asked the Messiah what would be the signs of his coming and of the end of this world, and he gave a whole list of stuff in Matthew 24 and Luke 25 and Mark 13, he said, you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. Nations shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There'll be an increase in famines and earthquakes and diseases and stuff like that. But he also said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be. And the big, big, big... Pardon?
I was going to ask you specifically about this, because and there's reasons why. Because that verse does say, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. So, I see the books that you've written and the message that you have here following along this line. And I guess I was going to ask you to expound on that, because I'm curious as to what conditions you feel are present now, that we're in the end times, that were present in the days of Noah.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily the conditions that were there and that are here now. When he said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be. The big, 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 big thing that happened in the days of Noah was the appearing of these gods. That's with a small g. These fallen angels on earth. And were manifest to the human race at that time. That was the big, big thing. And everything stemmed from that.
Well, the reason
as it was, so shall it be.
Our telephone system here isn't exactly duplex. But what I was going to say is that, you know, we have there's since the 1950s, of course, we've had an increase in flying saucer sightings, people seeing flying saucers. There has been people now, documentation with people like this Dr. Mack and whatnot, of abductions, people being taken in to what they believe to be spacecraft and examined. And, of course, there's cattle mutilations. There's all kinds of weird stuff going on like that. And I guess I've wondered about that. I thought to myself, I'm wondering, maybe that wasn't what was going on in the days of Noah specifically, but it was an appearance of a foreign race of a different type. Whether they were from the stars or whether they where they were from, I mean, you were saying fallen angels. I'm wondering, what is your take on this? What is your take on all the activities that are being reported today that have to do with UFO sightings, the sudden interest in haunted houses and going into all these places and trying to record and photograph spirits, and all, it just seems like there's an outbreak of all of this, including alien abductions of people and that sort of thing. Is there a parallel here?
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say to you. What is happening is that the world, the people of the world are being conditioned for what is coming down the tracks. And what is coming down the tracks is the return of the Nephilim. These guys are coming back. As I said to you just a little bit earlier there, you cannot drown spirit men. So we're told that these spirit men, these fallen angels, are locked up in the subterranean prison, which is called the bottomless pit or Tartarus. And according to Revelation chapter 9, in the coming apocalypse, this bottomless pit is going to be opened and these guys are going to be released onto the earth again. And they're going to be manifest on the earth again. In fact, we're given the name of the leader of them, who also goes on to become what we call the Antichrist. His name is given in Revelation chapter 9, verse 11. It's been hidden in plain sight before our eyes all these centuries, and nobody really copped on to what it meant. About the same time that these guys are released onto the earth in Revelation chapter 9, at the beginning of the apocalypse, it talks in Revelation 12 about a war in heaven. And it says, Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, who is the devil, and his angels, his evil angels. And it says, their place was found no more in heaven, and they are cast down to the earth. And it says, woe unto the inhabitants of the earth, for the devil is cast down unto the earth. So, about the same time that these 200, according to the Book of Enoch, there's 200 of these fallen angels, they're going to be released out of the bottomless pit onto the earth with their leader, who's called the beast from the bottomless pit, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and who goes on to become the Antichrist. Around the same time, the devil and the rest of the angels that rebelled. Remember, when Lucifer rebelled way, way, way back, you know, thousands of years ago, he tried to usurp the throne of the Most High God in a military coup, and he finished. But contrary to popular belief, those guys were not kicked out of heaven at that time. They are still there, because it says in Revelation chapter 12 that day and night the dragon appears before the throne of God, condemning the brethren, cursing the brethren. In other words, day and night he has access to heaven and to the throne of God, where he is rehearsing the sins of all the Christians before God. But, so maybe heaven is a bit like our world, Ted. Maybe, you know, God and the Messiah and the 24 elders and all the good angels are in one place, say over in Tennessee, and the devil and all the third of the angels that rebelled with him, are in another place, somewhere in heaven, like maybe in Ireland. But because he's a spirit being, still has access to the throne of God, and he still rehearses the sins of the Christians before God. Day and night, we're told he does this.
Well, but he's referred to...
In this coming war...
He's referred to as the Accuser. So, you know,
the Accuser, that's right. That's one of his names. Because he's accusing the brethren day and night. He's saying, look at that Paddy Aaron over there. He'd 5 pints of Guinness the other night, you know, and then went home and had a row with his wife and kicked the cat, you know. So he's rehearsing our sins. So these guys are going to get the boot out of heaven. There's a third of the angels up there. I mean, there's probably a lot of these evil angels still have access to the heavenly realm. They're going to get the boot, and they're going to be cast down to earth at the same time that the other angels who are locked up in the bottom of the pit are going to be released. So to get back to your question, all this stuff that's been going on since the 50s with UFO sightings, flying saucers, abductions, then you throw in. The next time you're sitting down in front of your TV, Ted, have a flick through the channels and look at how many channels are mystical, spiritual, about fallen angels or aliens or extraterrestrials or beings coming to Earth or humans interacting. Every second program almost on the television now is mystical stroke spiritual, you know. And what it's doing, what all this stuff is doing, not just TV programs, but all the movies that are out there, Knowing, Star Trek, you know, Drag Me to Hell or something. There's loads and loads and loads of them. Every second movie and TV program, it seems at the moment, is mystical. I believe what's happening is that the world is being conditioned for the manifestation of these angels on the earth again in a very, very big way. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be. Now, you know, we can talk about the wars, rumors of wars, famines, earthquakes, diseases, and all that other stuff. And especially the Jews being back in Israel, that's a big sign. But when he said, as it was, so shall it be, I believe he was talking about the manifestation of these spirit men, these gods, who manifested on earth, who were beautiful-looking men, who were spiritually endowed, powerful beings, and who could deceive people with their lying signs and wonders. As it was, so shall it be. We're told that when the Antichrist comes, he's going to have a sidekick with him called the false prophet. And it says they'll deceive almost the whole world with their lying signs and wonders. Just as the true Messiah did signs, miracles, and wonders when he was here, so these guys, this Antichrist, he's going to be in the stead of Christ. That's what anti means. It means in the stead of. He's going to be coming as the true Messiah, and he's going to deceive people with his lying miracles and lying signs and wonders. I wouldn't be surprised if he changes water into wine, if he feeds hungry people with very little food, on water and goes
something
like that.
Something else on that verse that you quoted, and that was, and this may be a different one, but it was something to the effect of, woe unto the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you having great wrath. Are you familiar with that at all, or is that the same verse that you were quoting earlier?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what I was quoting. I was just quoting that off the top of my head.
Well, the thing I was wondering about is the great wrath. It says, "Come, it's woe." It says, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, because the devil is coming down unto you with great wrath." And I mean, I wonder what the great wrath is all about, or what does that imply?
Well, you know, a lot of people try to split up the Book of Revelation from the tribulation to the great tribulation, from the wrath to the great wrath. But in my studies, I can honestly say I don't see a difference in all these times. There's different names for the apocalypse, the time of the apocalypse. It's called the day of wrath. It's called the day of tribulation. The great tribulation, it's called the day of vengeance. It's called the Lord's day. It's called the day of his burning anger. It's called the great and terrible day of the Lord. It's called the cruel day with wrath and fierce anger. It's also called the day of Jacob's trouble. It's called the day of Christ. It's got several different names, but it's all referring to the same period, I believe, which is the period of the apocalypse, which most scholars say is 7 years long. It might be 3.5 years long. Some scholars say it's 3.5 years long. Others say 7 years. It's all talking about the same time. There's three wraths talked about in the Book of Revelation. The wrath of the devil, which you just quoted. It talks about God's wrath, and it talks about the wrath of the Lamb. But when you go back to the Book of Daniel and other places, it talks about the time of the end being the time of the wrath. So the whole period, in my opinion, when these guys appear on the earth at the beginning, the Antichrist appears, the whole thing is the day of wrath. And, I mean, it's no wonder that it says the devil is cast down having great wrath, because he knows his time is short. Because by the end of the Book of Revelation, by the end of the apocalypse, something like 2/3 of the people in the world are going to be dead. And that could be, in today's terms, that's 3-4 billion people. This is totally unprecedented death. This is why it's called Great Wrath, Great Tribulation, the Day of Wrath and Cruel Anger. But this is all going to begin when the bottomless pit is opened. It talks about a great smoke comes out of the bottomless pit, which blacks out the sun and the stars. I wouldn't be surprised. From a couple of other readings I've done in the Old Testament, it talks about the earth being plunged into darkness. Perhaps the earth is going to be plunged into darkness for a few days. And then when this darkness dissipates and the light comes back, I think these guys are going to be manifest on the earth. And people are going to say, oh my God, what are these guys? But because of the conditioning they've had with the UFOs, flying saucers, abductions, and all these various movies and books and TV programs over the last decades, and especially at the moment. I mean, just check it out in the pictures, the movies, next time you're there, or next time you're flicking through your channels. It's just unbelievable. Everybody from the cradle to the grave has been conditioned for the appearance of these guys. That's what the big deal is going to be.
When you were talking, you were talking about the Antichrist in the book of Revelation, and I think you were saying in Revelation chapter 9. I guess my question is you were talking about that his name has been obscured, I guess I want to say, although it's been plainly right in front of us. And
hidden in plain sight.
Okay. There's been so many predictions. I mean, there's been so many people that have labeled an Antichrist. You know, I remember back when I was a kid, they said that John F. Kennedy was the Antichrist, and that he was actually still alive inside of this hospital down in Texas. I mean, I've heard all kinds of stuff. What is your take on that? Who do you believe? I guess, and not necessarily naming names, but where is the Antichrist going to come from? What type of person is he going to be? And how would we go about trying to identify him? And if he does have a name, how would we figure that out what that name is?
Well, that's a fantastic question, and I'm glad you asked me that, as the fella said. The words the Antichrist are only used twice in the whole of Scripture, and that's in the epistles, John's epistles. Only twice. He's never called the Antichrist in the book of Revelation. He's called the beast from the abyss. In fact, to give him his full title, he's called the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit, having 7 heads and 10 horns. That's his full title. And he's called the beast from the abyss no less than 35 times in the book of Revelation. How often do we hear people referring to him as the beast from the abyss? Hardly ever. What is the abyss? Why does he have to ascend out of it? What are the 7 heads? What do the 10 horns represent? Who is this guy? Basically, that's what I tackle in my new book, if I can get a little plug-in for it. It's an e-book, and it only costs $5 to download. It's called The Return of the Antichrist and the New World Order. And that's on my website, which is www.neph.ie. Neph.ie, okay? So, in Revelation chapter 9, verse 11, it talks about this man. And he's a man, by the way. That's why he's called the man of sin, the son of perdition, the man of lawlessness. He's got several other names, like the king of Assyria, the stern-faced king, you know, the Daniel's man with a small horn of Revelation, and various other names. But his basic name is the beast from the abyss. So, in Revelation chapter 9, it talks about these angels in the bottomless pit, and it says they have a king over them, who's the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and his name in the Greek tongue is Apollyon, A-P-O-L-L-Y-O-N. And his name means the destroyer. And it says he ascends out of the bottomless pit and goes to his destruction, which doesn't mean that he goes out and gets destroyed. It means that by the end of the book of Revelation, he's managed to destroy 2/3 of the population of the whole world. That's why he's called the destroyer. So his names are given right in Revelation 9:11 as being Abaddon in Hebrew and Apollyon in Greek. Now, I don't know what Abaddon refers to particularly, but Apollyon, A-P-O-L-L-Y-O-N, in Greek is how we spell Apollo. He is the guy that we call Apollo in our language. And Apollo, as you know, was one of the original leaders of the original pantheon of gods that lived on Mount Olympus and Delphi and Greece and Turkey and that area way, way back 1,000 years before the flood of Noah. And he was a god. Apollo was a god back then with other gods such as Mars, Saturn, Pluto, Mercury, Zeus, Poseidon, Jupiter, Venus, Orion, Athena, which is a female goddess. So this is who this guy is. He's called Apollo or Abaddon, and he is the beast from the abyss that goes on to become what we call the Antichrist. Now, he is locked up in the bottomless pit, and he's there since the time of the flood of Noah. Remember I said you can't drown spirit men. We're told that these guys are locked up in Tartarus, or the bottomless pit, or the abyss, because of the sin and violence that they caused in the days of Noah. In fact, we're told that the Messiah, Jesus, in his risen body, when he got up from the dead, he had a new spiritual body, so he could do things that he couldn't do with his flesh and blood body. He could disappear through walls and do various things like that. And we're told in Peter, in the Epistle of Peter, that the Messiah, Jesus, in his risen body, went and preached to these spirits in Tartarus, which caused the sin in the days of Noah. But that preach there is caruso, which means he heralded his victory over them. This is the word caruso you would use of, for instance, a Roman general returning from a foreign campaign would parade his captives and his slaves and his treasures that he was after bringing back from his campaign before the citizens of Rome. He heralded his triumph over these captors. So in the same way, the Messiah, Jesus, did this. He went and appeared to these spirits, which are spirit men. They're fallen angels. They're spirits, but they're men. Angels are spirits. And he appeared to them and said, "Hard luck, boys. I'm up from the dead. All your plans have come to naught, and I'll be back," or words to that. To that end, and he appeared to them. So we're told that these guys in Revelation 9, this pit is going to be opened. They're going to be released onto the earth again after over 4,000 years of being locked up in there. And the leader of this guy, the king over them, he's called king, which in Revelation means a leader. He could be the president or the prime minister or the head, but he's the leader of these angels, and his name is, as we would know it, is Apollo, and he is the Antichrist. Now you asked, how will we know him? Well, he's going to do a bunch of different things when he arrives on the earth, whereby we can recognize him. Him along with this other guy called the false prophet, who also ascends up out of the earth. He's another fallen angel that's locked up and down there. So the first thing we have to know is that he's a man, although he's a spirit man, but he looks like us. Let us make man in our image, in the image of God made he man. So we look like them. It said he's going to be a deceiver. He's going to deceive almost the whole world with his lying signs and wonders. So he's a supernatural being, a spirit powerful being. Ordinary, you know, John F. Kennedy didn't do any supernatural wonders and miracles. Either did, you know, Hitler or Stalin or Tony Blair or George Bush or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or anybody else. They were just men. Or Obama is not going to do any either. People might think that he's going to change water into wine and feed the hungry, but it's not going to happen. When this guy turns up, you will know him because he's going to be doing supernatural miracles, lying signs and wonders. And it says he will astonish the whole world when he does this. In fact, it says in Revelation 17, "The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction."
Don't you think
the inhabitants of the...
I'm sorry, I shouldn't interrupt you, but a thought occurred to me, and that is, don't you think, with all the conditioning now, that the entire world is going to think or probably be told that he is a superior being from another planet, and they are an advanced race, you know, coming to Earth to save us from our own demise?
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of the, if you go to a lot of the UFO people that are into aliens and ETs, they believe that this is coming. They believe that there's a planet called the Planet X or Nibiru, and it's due to make it, you know, come close to the Earth. I think they say in 2012, which sort of ties in with the Mayan calendar and such like. And they believe that the gods who planted the seed of mankind here thousands of years ago are going to come back again when Planet X comes back close to the Earth again, and that they're going to come back to the Earth, they're going to save humankind from itself, they're going to bring humankind to the next level of evolution, and to the next plane of enlightenment, where we'll get rid of all the hunger and all the wars and all the injustices that are going on in the world. They firmly believe this, so you're absolutely right. And when this guy comes on the Earth, he is the, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The first rider that goes out is riding a white horse, and he's got a bow with no arrow in it. Now, the white horse is to signify that he is in the stead of the Messiah, because at the end of the book of Revelation, it says that the Messiah, Jesus, comes back riding on a white horse. He's the true Messiah. But this guy is in the stead of, he's a counterfeit Messiah. So he goes out on a counterfeit white horse with a bow with no arrow. And the bow with no arrow means he goes out to bring peace to the world. You know, and even though he preaches peace, and there will be a pseudo-peace on the world for a certain period of time, when everybody is going to embrace this man, they're going to love him, they're going to worship him, they're going to bow down to his image to such a degree that they will take a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, pledging their allegiance to this man, which is called the Beast from the Abyss. So astonished, because it says the inhabitants of the world, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come.
Okay,
and
now that's Revelation. All right, now that in itself has been something that has been a point of contention, and a point that people have referred to in regards to the Antichrist, because it says something that he'll suffer a mortal wound of some sort. And of course, this was the theory behind, I mean, this is what was spouted off when they said John F. Kennedy was the Antichrist, because he had suffered this mortal wound, but he was going to come back to life. And I think even when Ronald Reagan was shot, there were folks that went down that road trying to say that Ronald Reagan was the Antichrist because he had been shot. You know, yeah. I mean, just such nonsense. So when it talks that he was not, and then he was not, and then he was, what is that referring to? What is that talking about?
That's not referring to him being receiving a fatal head wound, which he will do. This guy is going to die, and he's going to be raised from the dead by the power of the dragon, it says. And that is your counterfeit resurrection, right? Because he's a counterfeit. What the devil always does is he always imitates or apes or copies what the true God does. So this guy is going to die in front of the eyes of the whole world. I'm sure Sky will be there, and Fox News and ABC and all the rest of them to record this. Then he's going to be miraculously raised from the dead, thus deceiving almost everybody in the whole world. But when it says the beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction, that's talking about a different thing. It says the beast which you saw once was. That means that he once was alive when he lived on the earth with the rest of the gods in the 1,000 years or so prior to the flood of Noah, and caused all the sin and evil and violence which precipitated in that day. Then it says he once was, now is not. The reason it says now is not is because now, presently, he's locked up in the bottomless pit, and he's not free to roam. And then it says, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. That's when he will be released in Revelation chapter 19 as Apollyon, or Apollo, who we call Apollo, and goes on to be the beast from the abyss, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and becomes what we call the Antichrist. That's what that phrase means there. And that's why it says, you know, all the people, you've got to remember, the people that are going to be deceived by this guy are not Christians. They're just ordinary Joe Soaps. They're body and soul people. They don't have body, soul, and spirit. So they've got no spiritual insight. So they're going to be hoodwinked by this guy and his sidekick, the false prophet. And that's why they will be astonished when they see the beast who once was, now is not, and yet will come.
Well, now the false prophet, we've heard, you know, I've heard the beast and the false prophet, of course, are referred to through prophecy and through Revelation. What will be the role of the false prophet? I mean, I guess, you know, we're looking at the beast or Apollyon being the boss man, you know, the head honcho. Now,
yeah.
The false prophet, on the other hand, is probably going to serve a different function. Is he going to be the public relations director of the apocalypse? Is that about what that amounts to?
It appears most of the scholars on this appear to think that he's going to be the religious side of the Antichrist, if there can be anyone more religious than the Messiah himself. I'll tell you what I found and what I speculate in my book, The Return of the Antichrist. Because it says that the beast rises up out of the earth with two horns. This is the false prophet. We have the beast from the sea, out of the bottomless pit, who's the Antichrist, or Apollyon, Apollo I call him, having seven heads and ten horns, which is seven and ten, that's 17 in total. And then it talks about the beast out of the earth with two horns, that's another three. So that's 20 in total of these guys. They're all fallen angels. I'll get back to that in a moment. But the beast with the two horns is the false prophet. And you know that the Muslims have prophetic writings regarding, which sort of parallel the apocalypse. And they're waiting for a guy to appear on the world stage called the 12th Imam, or the Mahdi. And they say that the 12th Imam, as a young boy of about 12 years old, several hundred years ago, went and hid down a well or hid down a tunnel in the earth somewhere. And he's going to come out of this well and he's going to appear as the Imam or Mahdi, and he's going to lead Islam in a series of apocalyptic battles and gain victory over her enemies and establish Islam as the religion, true religion of the world. And when this guy comes back, he's going to have a sidekick. And his sidekick is going to be none other than, you guessed it, Jesus Christ. That's what their prophecies say. Now, I have a funny inkling that this false prophet with the two horns may be the Mahdi, or the 12th Imam. And that when the Antichrist comes along, it talks about the goat from the west attacking this other goat with the two horns and knocking them down, subduing him. I think when the Antichrist comes, he might have to confront this Imam, or 12th Mahdi, and kick his ass somewhat to get him on side. And that together, they will be the counterfeit Messiah who will be acceptable to all the Jews present at that time, and to what I call Christendom, which are all the Christian churches in the church who say they believe in Jesus Christ, but they don't believe in him at all, like the Roman Catholic Church or, you know, all these Church of England or Methodist Church, who, you know, they're just religions. They're just nominal Christianity. And now, I was a Roman Catholic, and I didn't know anything about Jesus Christ until I was 24. So I know what I'm talking about. So the Messiah is going to be acceptable to the Jews, because they're still waiting for their Messiah to appear. So this guy will fulfill that role. He'll be acceptable to Christendom. But to get the 1 billion Muslims on side, we have the Mahdi, who will be the sidekick of the beast, of the Apollo, the Antichrist. Now, that is a bit of speculation on my behalf at the moment. But I think it's very interesting that in the prophecies of the Word of God, which is the truth, by the way, we have the Antichrist and this guy called the false prophet. And then in the Muslim prophecy writings of the end time, they've got two men also, the Mahdi and Jesus Christ. So I think there's a parallel between the two prophecies there.
Well, do you think what role do you think Islam will play? Or right now, Islam is on such a sharp increase all over the world. I mean, it is a rising religion that is growing, you know, by leaps and bounds. And I guess my question is what role do you think Islam will play in the apocalypse?
Well, I mean, when this guy arrives, Ted, he's going to initially bring a pseudo-peace on the world for a certain amount of time. I don't know how long. Maybe for half the apocalypse. And then things are going to start falling apart. So the Muslims will be on side, and they will be partaking of this whole. Because remember, it says in Revelation that everybody in the whole world are going to give their allegiance to this guy. All nations, all languages, all tongues. Everybody, this isn't just confined to Europe or something like that. This is going to be the whole world are going to be locked up under the one world government under this guy's presidency or the head or whatever he's going to be of this. This is, by the way, the 10 heads and 7 or the 7 heads and 10 horns. Perhaps we should talk about that for a few moments. It's going to be a worldwide thing. So everybody is going to buy in to this guy's political line for a certain amount of time. And then at some stage, the wheels are going to start coming off the whole thing. Then there's going to be, you know, wars, and people are going to be dying. It talks about an army from the east numbering 200 million. And when they march westward, it says they're going to wipe out about a third of the population of the earth in their march westward. Now, that army of 200 million from the east has to be the Chinese. They can be slaughter everything in front of them on their march westward. So that's when a lot of people are going to start dying. And I presume the Muslims will be doing their bit at that point in time, too. They're going to start kicking up. And I presume there's be wars and rumors of everything we're seeing now are just what I call the shadows of the apocalypse. Everything is going to be increased 1,000-fold. And then I'd imagine it's just going to deteriorate more, worse and worse and worse. If the Chinese are going to be involved coming from the east, then you've got Indonesia, you've got all the Muslims in India over there, and you know, a lot of other stuff going on. So the whole thing is going to turn into a hellhole. But I think for the first half, or first certain amount of the apocalypse, I presume the Muslims are going to toe the line that the Antichrist and the false prophet, who very well may be the Mahdi, are going to put together. Because we're told in Daniel 9:27 that he's going to broker a peace deal between the Arabs and their Jewish, or the Jews and their Arab neighbors. And that's going to last for a certain amount of time. And then the whole thing will start falling apart. And I'm sure the Muslims, as well as everybody else, will be, you know, blowing everybody to kingdom come, especially for the second half of the apocalypse.
You mentioned China, you know, and I guess I sit back and I wonder about the massive population of the People's Republic of China. And of course, there's a religious cult over there now that's sweeping through China, and I can't recall the name of it. But it's even caused the government quite a bit of concern over there.
I know who you're talking about. We have them here in Dublin as well.
Okay, but I don't know the name. Do you recall the name of the?
I forgot the name. It might come to me in a minute. I know who you're talking about, though.
And I have no idea what that movement is. I have no idea what they teach. I just know that the government over there is very concerned about its wide sweeping effects that it's had on the Chinese population, and a lot of the younger people are following after this cult. How do you see China in prophecy as far as the Book of Revelation and Daniel and all of that? I mean, are there references directly made to China that you can think of, is that something kind of left for the end time?
I'll tell you what it says in Revelation. It says the kings of the east rising. That's what it says, the kings of the east rising. And then it gives a number of the troops coming from the east, 200 million troops. Now, at the moment, I believe the Chinese have a standing army of 100 million men. And they're adding nuclear submarines and warheads. Somebody told me that if the Chinese Air Force started taking off now, right now, which is 5 minutes after 2, your time, then at this time tomorrow they're still taking off. They're huge, absolutely huge. So when it talks about the kings of the east rising and an army of 200 million wiping out one-third of the population in their march westward, it has to be the Chinese they're talking about. By the way, you know, there's another huge cult movement going on in China at the moment too, and that's evangelical Christians. I even heard a guy on the radio talk show here in Ireland 2 weeks ago. He's written a book about God, about the resurgence of God around the world. And he said, we might think in our Western secular society that God has gone out of fashion, but the opposite is the truth. And he was just talking about how God is becoming more and more popular all over the world, except in Europe. And he talked about being at a Bible study class in China, where it was very secretive, and he had to go to do it, and everybody came in secret, and they all studied their Bible for a few hours in this place. Then they snuck out of the place and went home. And the last I heard, there was anything from 80 to 100 million evangelical Christians in China now. And because they have so little, Ted, they really, really walk out on their faith. And they have great belief and faith. And as a result of that, signs, miracles, and wonders are happening over there. When Mao Zedong took over in the People's Revolution, back in the 50s, I guess it was, they reckon there was about 1 million evangelical Christians in China. Now they reckon there's anything from 80 million to 100 million, which is incredible, out of a population of anything from, 1.4 billion to 1.6 billion. So there's a big, big Christian evangelical stirring going on out there at the moment too in China. Other than that, I think the Chinese, see, the 10 heads, when it talks about the beast rising up out of the abyss having 10 heads and 7 horns, the ten horns relate to the prophecy in the book of Daniel of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had when he dreamed about this statue with the head of gold, the chest of brass, the belly of or chest of silver, the belly of brass, and then the legs of iron. Were the different empires, you know, the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, Alexander the Great, Greek Empire, the Roman Empire. Then he talked about a future empire that was come in the last days. And it was 2 feet, having 10 toes. And the toes are made up out of clay and iron. And it says, even as clay does not mingle with iron, so the two shall not cleave together. And then it says, they shall mingle their seed with the seed of men. I believe this is a reference to the fallen angels, and that when the Antichrist comes to power, excuse me, he is going to establish, he's going to split the world up into 10 regions, 10 supranational states or super states, and they're going to be under the governorship of 10 of these fallen angels. That's the iron, together with human politicians. That's the clay and iron. We're the clay. Dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. Whereas compared to these fallen angels, they're like iron or steel compared to us, because they are supernatural, powerful, spiritual beings. This is what the 10 heads are. When he receives his power from the dragon, it says he's going to be the head man, let's say the president, and he's going to be the president of these 10 super nation states. The world will be split up into 10. And that's what's being set up in the world at the moment. Over here we have the EU. The EU will soon be one super state with its own president and its own foreign minister. The United States is joining up, I believe, with Canada and Mexico, and they're going to be called maybe the North American states. That's another one entity. The South America would be another one. Russia would be another one. China would be another one. Islam would be another one. And I believe the UN already have the world split up into 10 geopolitical regions. So that's what the 10 heads are. When this guy comes to power, he's going to lead a government with 10 other guys underneath him. And that's the 10 toes of the statue in Daniel chapter 2 of iron and clay. Human politicians together with these fallen angels. What are the 7 heads, you might add? Because when the beast comes up out of the abyss, he's going to have 10 heads. And these are 10 kings, by the way. You can read the explanation of what these guys are in Revelation chapter 17 and 18. And I go through this line by line in my new ebook, The Return of the Antichrist. And it's very simple. It tells you the 10 heads, the 10 horns are 10 kings. And it says the 7 heads are 7 kings. Just similar to the king Apollo, who rose up out of the abyss. He's the king of the angels. So too, these 7 and 10 are 17 other fallen angels. And possibly the 7 heads may be what we call the 7 permanent members, like of the UN at the moment. Because when you listen to these globalists who are pushing the New World Order, who want a one world government, one world currency, one world religion, you know, to be run by one guy, they always talk about the UN as being the vehicle whereby they can attain this future government that they're trying to push into place. And I believe that this guy, when he comes, will possibly be the head of the UN, and that the other 10 supranational regions will be his heads of state or prime ministers or heads of their particular states together with human politicians. So that's what the 10 heads are. And as I say, or the 10 horns are, that are 10 kings, and the 7 heads are maybe like what we have at the moment, 7 permanent heads of the UN. and we have a G20 at the moment. Well, that eventually that's going to be a G10. And that's going to be the setup.
The one thing that a lot of folks are familiar with in the book of Revelation, and you hear this talked about and bantered about a bit, and that is the reference to the star Wormwood. Do you cover anything about that at all, or do you have a take on Wormwood, where it talks about the star Wormwood, falling into the ocean or whatever, and poisoning a third of the waters or two thirds of the waters? All that kind of mixes up in my head. I don't know the exact proportions, but what about Wormwood?
Okay, well, Wormwood is the guy that falls onto the waters and pollutes a third of the drinking water. Okay. That's what he does. And if people drink this water, then they're going to die because it's poisoned. Now, I used to believe that Wormwood was like a... It says a great burning star falls on these things. And in the book of Enoch, several times Enoch sees these seven burning stars. And he says, what are these burning mountains? And he says, these burning mountains are the seven stars which transgressed and slept with women and are locked up in the bottomless pit. So the burning mountain is a metaphor for very powerful angels. That's what it's a metaphor for. For instance, it says a star falls from heaven with the key to the bottomless pit. Well, the star falling from heaven with the key to the bottomless pit is a metaphor for an angel falling from heaven, because stars don't have keys and they don't open prisons. It's a metaphor. Very often it talks about the host of heaven or the stars of heaven, referring to them as the angels of God. In like manner, it refers to mountains as being particular angels. It talks, as I say, in the book of Enoch about seven burning mountains. And it says that these are seven angels. So twice, I think, in the book of Revelation, it talks about burning angels. One falls into the ocean and kills a third of all living things in the seas and all the ships that go on the sea. Excuse me. And the other one is a burning star that falls on the waters, which is called Wormwood. And I think that is one of these fallen angels. And somehow he poisons a third of the water. Now, this is just speculation on my half again. But just as we speculated that, we didn't speculate, we pointed out that Apollyon is Apollo. And he was one of the original gods way back in the time of Noah. That's who he was. Likewise, he is the rider on the white horse with four horsemen of the apocalypse. And the white horse is the Antichrist, his Apollyon or Apollo, the beast from the abyss, or the Antichrist. The next horse is a red horse, and he is given a sword to bring war on the earth, that men would kill one another with swords, etc. And he's on a red horse. Now, interestingly, the god of war in old Greek and Roman mythology was Mars, and Mars is a red planet. So as Apollo is referring to the sun and is associated with Helios, who's the sun god, so I think the god of war is Mars, and that's the god in the red horse. Then the black horse comes along, and black always denotes famine in the Bible. And it says the rider on the black horse has the scales in his hand, and he says three handfuls of wheat for a day's work, and one handful of barley for a day's work, and do not hurt the oil or the wine. What he's signifying there is that he's signifying worldwide famine, because if you get three handfuls of wheat and one handful of barley for a day's wages, then you're talking about economic collapse, you're talking about worldwide famine, you're talking about no food. This is the black horse. And the god of commerce, always in Greek and Roman mythology, was the god Mercury. Now, Mercury, also, as you also know, if you take it, you swallow a tiny drop of mercury, you're dead instantly. So maybe, again, I'm speculating here, maybe that burning mountain, which, as I say, is a metaphor for a fallen angel, that falls and poisons a third of the drinking water on the earth, perhaps that's Mercury, I'm not sure. And then the rider on the pale horse, the pale horse is always is called death. And that refers to the angel of death. And he's mentioned in the Genesis when the angel of death passed over Egypt, and all the eldest male in the households of the Egyptians and the male horses and cows and sheep and everything died. He's the angel of death, and he's on the pale horse, thus the expression as pale as death. And of course, Hades, or the grave, always follows death, just as the grave and death always follows pestilence and famine. So death and the grave follow one another. So perhaps that poisoning of all a third of the angels is another supernatural act by one of these fallen angels. Maybe it's Mercury. That's as much as I know. One way or another, Ted, a third of the drinking water is going to be polluted. And somebody told me that Wormwood has some connection with Chernobyl. So I don't know. Maybe there'll be some nuclear fallout will be attached into it. Something I'd like to emphasize here, and I have to, you know, show everybody my cards. The Church of God, which is the Christians, you referred earlier to just people, ordinary people who accept Jesus as their Lord and Savior, and they get saved or they get born again. Call it what you will. Once a person is saved, you're in the body of Christ, and you're a member of the Church of God. And church, the Greek for church is ekklesia. It means the called out. He's the head, we're members of the body. We're all part of it. It doesn't matter whether you're a Pentecostal or a Baptist or a Catholic or anything. If you believe in Jesus, you're in that body of Christ, in the Church of God. When he comes back briefly, he's taking out his church, and those church are going out. They're going to where he is now. Because he said in John chapter 14, in my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. So for the last 2,000 years, he's been preparing a place for a big visitation. He's coming back briefly. He's gathering together his bride, which is his church, and bringing them to this place in this parallel universe. We call it heaven, where these other beings live, called God, the Most High God, sitting on his throne, sitting beside him is the Messiah, his son, surrounded by 24 elders, we're told, who have 24 thrones, sitting on 24 thrones with crowns on their head. We don't know who they are, because we're not given their names, so we won't speculate. And in turn, they are surrounded by a myriad of these spirit men we call angels. So when we go there, that's when, you know, all the light goes out of the world, and that's when the guacamole hits the fan. That's when the world is going to be plunged into darkness. And when when people wake up one day and all these guys appear on the earth, both Apollo or Abaddon or Apollyon, the beast from the abyss, is going to be the leader, and the rest of these other guys, the devil and his angels, are cast down to the earth. And I believe they're going to be manifest as themselves on the earth. I don't think they're going to be possessing anybody. And as we discussed earlier, I think that's why all this conditioning is going on with all the movies and films at the moment, to prepare the world for what's coming down. That's when all this stuff is going to happen. The Church of God is not part of the apocalypse. It's not part of it, absolutely. This stuff cannot happen until the church first goes.
Well, now
I have a whole chapter.
The evangelicals, especially, for example, the Baptists and several others, teach of what they consider or call the rapture, or the rapture of the church. And there are those that believe it's going to take place prior to the tribulation. There are those that believe it's going to take place in the middle of the tribulation, and there are those that believe it'll take place after the tribulation. I guess they call all three of those pre-trib, mid-trib, and post-trib. Those are the doctrinal beliefs of various facets of Christianity as we know it. Of course, the most important thing in all of this is to be part of the body of Christ, regardless of when you believe the rapture is going to take place. But the thing that I would like to ask you is, you are of the belief that this rapture, so to speak, or catching away of the church, is going to happen prior to the 7 years of tribulation, or the terrible time, and before the abyss is open and the beast and the false prophet come forth. You think this is going to happen before that happens?
I have absolutely no doubt about it, because that's what the scriptures teach. It three different times in there, Paul tells us we are saved from the wrath to come. I've done a whole chapter in my new ebook on 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 to 10, where Paul goes through this whole thing verse by verse and line by line. And he says that this day cannot come. And he's talking about the day of the Lord, which is the day of wrath or the day of tribulation or the day of Jacob's trouble, whatever you want to call it. He says that day cannot come until there first comes a departure. Then the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, the man of lawlessness. You know, and it says, and he goes on to say, now you know what's holding him back or restraining him or keeping him in his place that he might be manifest in his time. And the whole thing that's keeping him back is the presence of the Church of God or the Holy Spirit in the Church of God in his body at this time presently. This is what's holding him back. Once the departure happens, and it says in there, now you know, it says, this day cannot come unless there first comes a departure. Now, that Greek for departure is hei apostasia, and it's been transliterated into apostasy. And loads of Bible teachers say, oh, there's going to be an apostasy, and then the end cannot come. And that is a wrong translation of that word. The original two Bibles, the Tyndale Bible and the Wycliffe Bible, I believe, which came out long before the King James Version, both translated apostasia as a departure. And apo in Greek is a very mathematical language. Apo, which means away, it means going away. It's always depicted in Greek as a line going from a circle. If you drew a circle and then you stuck your pencil in the middle of that circle and drew a line going away in an outward direction from that circle, that's the preposition apo in Greek. It's a departure. It's like when you go into a departure lounge to get and then you get on the plane and you take off. You're going away from the circumference of the earth. That's what that word means. And it cannot happen. This man of sin, the Antichrist, cannot be revealed until first comes a departure. And Paul calls it the gathering together of the church. That's what he calls it in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 1. He's talking about the gathering together, which a lot of Americans call the rapture. And as I say, that's why it says we're saved from the wrath to come. So we're either saved from it or not. We're not saved from it. So I choose to believe Paul, who wrote by direct revelation from Jesus Christ himself. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 10, he said, we're to wait for Jesus Christ from heaven, who has rescued us from the coming wrath. So we're absolutely not going through it. That's what the scripture teaches, you know. So that's all I can go by. And also, you know, people... Pardon?
Go ahead.
People also say, well, it never says anywhere in scripture that we're going to heaven. Well, I just quoted John 14 a few minutes ago. In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place, I will come again. I mean, why is he preparing a place if we're not going there? You know, and I even had one person said to me last year, Ted, they said, well, Jesus only said we were going to heaven once. And I said, well, how many times does he need to say it before you're going to believe it? You know, twice, three times, 10 times? If Jesus Christ said something once, then you can put your house on it because it's going to happen. So we're saved from the coming wrath. In fact, I have another chapter in my new ebook called The Unwise Virgins of Revelation. And you remember the parable of the five wise virgins and the five unwise virgins.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this parable had to do with they had their lamps, the five wise virgins had trimmed their lamps so that when it was time to go out to meet the bridegroom, they would be ready. But the five unwise virgins had not enough oil in their lamps. So it says they were all asleep one night, and it said, the call came, go out to meet your bridegroom. Right? So the wise virgins had enough oil, and the other one said, well, you give us some of your oil so we'll have enough oil to go out to meet them. And they said, well, we cannot do that, or else we mightn't have enough oil, so you go and buy oil from the guy that sells oil, and then you can have enough. So it says, the five wise virgins went out to meet their bridegroom. But while they were gone, while the other ones went away to buy oil, the door was shut and the wedding begun. And then the other ones come back and they said, let us in. And they said, it's too late. I don't know who you are. You know, they missed the boat. The train had left the station. This whole parable is about the bride going out to meet the bridegroom. And that's what we are. We are the bride of Christ. when he comes back, we're going out to meet our bridegroom, and we're going to be presented to his father back in heaven. And that's when I believe the devil and the rest of his guys, there's going to be no room left for them up there. War in heaven. Not a battle, but a war. And that's when the devil and the rest of his angels are cast down to earth. When Jesus brings back his bride, the five wise virgins who had trimmed their lamps and were ready to go out to meet the bridegroom. The unwise virgins are all those people, and we all know them, Ted. I've got people in my family that don't believe in Jesus Christ, yet they all go to Mass every Sunday. You know, there's 5 million Catholics in Ireland. I'd say 95% of them don't know anything, very little about salvation or being born again or saved or Jesus Christ. They haven't a clue. So there's about 1 billion people in what I call Christendom, so-called Christian churches, that are not Christian at all. I believe they and all those other people who've heard of the salvation message, they've heard of Jesus Christ, but they never accepted him. They are the unwise virgins of Revelation. They're the people who are going to be caught up in this apocalyptic time warp when it occurs. And they're going to wake up some morning, they're going to switch on the news and hear that several hundred million people have vanished off the face of the earth. They're going to say, oh my God, the rapture has happened, and I refuse to believe. And then they're going to be the ones who will believe during that time period. And there's going to be a huge amount of them. Multitudes of people.
We are about out of time. I want you to give out your website address so folks know where to go. Once again, our guest, Patrick Herron, and the name of the new book that he has out, which is an e-book that you can buy online and download, is The Return of the Antichrist and the New World Order by Patrick Herron. He's also the author of The Nephilim and Pyramid of the Apocalypse, which are two very, very fascinating books that you're going to want to read. So why don't you go ahead and give out the website right now, and then I'm gonna ask you to do one more thing after you do that.
Okay, Ted. My website is very, very simple. www.neph.ie. That's the short for Nephilim. Nephilim is the fallen ones. It's Nephilim. So this is neph.ie. And if you go on there, my cover to my new book comes up, which is a real cool cover, and you can read the introduction to my new book on there and see the table of contents. It's only $5 to download. If you don't like reading books, then I have some DVDs, one called The Return of the Nephilim, which is really good. I made that at a UFO conference 2 years ago, and it's got a PowerPoint, 50 PowerPoint pictures and video clips in there, and that's very good too. So it's neph.ie. What else did you want me to say, Ted?
All right. In closing, I want you to tell folks in regards to what do you believe that a person can do to escape being here on this planet when that abyss opens up and that beast and false prophet come belching out of the abyss. What is it that a person can do today to prevent being caught in the middle of that?
It's very, very, very simple. All you have to do is believe. All you have to do is to take that step, a personal thing. You can do this sitting on your couch, lying in your bed, if you go for a walk in the woods, down by the river. If you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior, and you believe in your heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. That's what it says in Romans 10:9-10. Confess him with your mouth, accept him as your personal Lord and Savior, and believe in your heart. Not that he was a great man, or he did great miracles, or he walked on water. It says, believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. The moment you do that, you experience the supernatural miracle of being born again, of being saved. You get the seed of God in you. You're going to heaven. All hell cannot stop you getting there. And for those of you that have not heard enough to believe in that, that's what I do in all my books. I give you enough evidence whereby you can come to an informed verdict on all these things. And all my books lead you to that decision. But they're also pretty fascinating reading if you want to learn about the fallen angels of Genesis 6 and also the return of these Nephilim, the return of these fallen angels, which is soon to happen on this earth. I believe this stuff is very close, Ted. I don't know what close is. I don't know whether it's 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. I just believe it's very, very, very close. And that's why I put this book out as an e-book, because I couldn't hang around waiting for it to be published and printed.
Do you think by any chance that the 2012 figure that's bandied around, which is the end of the Mayan calendar and all the predictions about Planet X coming back, Nibiru and all this, do you think all of this may tie together with this, or do you think that's just more misinformation?
I don't know. When they asked Jesus for dates, he said, don't worry about dates. He says, no man knows the day or the hour. We can see generally that we're in the end times now. We know that by all the signs that we're given. And the main one being the fact that the Jews are back in Israel. That's a big sign. We're in the end times. We can see that spiritually. But I would never try and put a date on it. In fact, I got emails from somebody saying that the other day when Pentecost happened, the rapture's going to happen. And now he's got egg all over his face because we're still here. No man knows the day or the hour. All I know is that it's soon. It's quite soon. If it's going to be 2012, I don't know. Might happen tomorrow for all I know. But the main thing you want to be doing is make sure you're ready for it, because you don't want to go through what's coming down the tubes. What's coming down the tubes is going to make the Holocaust look like an afternoon tea party. You don't want to be there, and you don't want your loved ones to be there. So I've made it available with this e-book that you can send it to your loved ones after you've read it too.
Well, I thank you so much for being on. We're going to have you come back, because you know what? I've got another list of 15 questions here that I'd like to ask you, but we don't have time on this broadcast, but we'll have to have you back very soon, and I'll start going down that list. And by the way, folks that are listening, you go to our website, radiodisclosure.com, and shoot an email if you have a question for Patrick Heron, and the next time he's on, we'll put those questions in front of him. Thank you so much for joining us, and we're going to have you back again soon.
Thank you very much, Ted. Thank you for having me on, and thank you to all your people that are listening out there in radio world. God bless you all from the Emerald Isle. Bye-bye.
As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Transworld Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building, and they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. TransworldAntennas.com. If you enjoy listening to Radio Disclosure, we would really appreciate hearing from you. You can write us an email from our website, and that's RadioDisclosure.com. All one word, RadioDisclosure.com. There's a place, the tab, where you can click on it and send us an email. Please do that and tell us where you're located, what you're listening on, and how the signal's coming in. We really want to hear from you. Just say hello. RadioDisclosure.com. That's going to do it for this week's Radio Disclosure. A special thanks to our guest, Emmy Award-winning reporter Linda Moulton Howe and Patrick Heron. Be sure to tune in next week, same time, same station, for Radio Disclosure.